All right, it's August 3rd, 2007, and I'm interviewing John Wallish.
Dan Wallersheim.
Or, I mean, Dan Wallish.
Wallersheim.
Wallersheim. Okay, Wallersheim. They gave you the wrong name. Yeah. Rollersheim. Okay, yeah. Like the winery in Wisconsin.
Right. Oh, yeah. German, yeah. Yeah. Matter of fact, I got some Wallersheim wine bottles up there.
Any relation to the people?
No.
No. Just
unless they're real distant before my knowledge of it.
But. Yeah, yeah. Just start out with who you are, when you were born, where you were raised, family background, things like that.
Well, I'm Dan Wallersheim. I live here in Neenah, Lake Winnebago. And I was born in Combined Locks. And at age three, it was 1931, December 13th, I was born. And then when I was 3 years old, my mother and my dad bought a farm out this side of Neenah here. And it's next to the, the mausoleum out here on 41, just outside of Neenah, the farm there. Well, I was there until I was 16 years old, and I went and got hired by Kimberly Clark as a maintenance mechanic and so on and so forth. And I lived in Neenah all my life, and I think nothing about accepting fish and fish more and more fish. And to me, there is not a cleaner sport. Sometimes now these days with so many fish out there, it gets kind of frustrating because some of these fellows I don't think should even be on the lake. Maybe about 50%, and the other 50% should be in kindergarten because they just have no scruples of what the old-time fishermen do and how to conduct themselves out there when they do. I mean, they practically run across your anchor ropes when you're fishing. All I do is structure fish. I don't troll with cane poles or six or nine lines. I use one line casting, and it's to be a headache out there with some of these characters out there, and I always said they should be to kindergarten before they should get a license to fish. I might be kind of hard on this, but it's just the way I feel about it, and there's a lot of older time people that feel the same way I do. So then I got involved in sturgeon fishing when I was in senior high school at Neenah, and John Gunlack, who was our biology teacher, he had a fish shanty, and we got talking sturgeon, and he said I could go out and use his fish shanty, which I did. And lo and behold, the first two, three times I fished, I did spear a fish. And I was very happy for that. And then the following year, I built my own fish shanties. And then I got so involved with it, I started building spears and so on and so forth. I think I built 130-some spears I sold and gave away and this and that. And then we used to cut holes with this handsaw, which is one hanging on the wall right there. First of all, we chopped them. We didn't have the handsaw at the time. And we chopped the sturgeon hole. Just so we wouldn't go through, we'd chop all the way around the perimeter and leave the cake in the center. And just as we were about to go through it, then we'd cut through all the way so the water wouldn't come up while you're doing the other work. And then we'd shove the cake under. Well, that went on for about maybe 10, 12 years. And finally, I run into this ice saw, and I bought that for $5. And then from then on, it was a lot easier.
When was that?
To be back in, I would say, 60, 61, 62. At that time, the DNR didn't have registration stations. And right down here by the Fresh Air Camp, which is only about two blocks down, they'd put up a little fish shanty, and they would hire somebody, or maybe one of their own personnel, and he would sit there, and he would register the fish as you came off. And he had that saw hanging in the shanty, and I says, where did you find that? He says, up for sale. He says, you want it? I says, yeah, I'd like to have it. I says, how much is it going to cost me? $5. Bought the cotton picker for $5. So anyhow, I cut quite a few holes with that. I mean, that's work, though, but it's not quite as much work as chopping them by hand. So then, after about a few years of that, I figured, geez, there's a better way. So I went and I bought the biggest steel chainsaw that they made at the time, what they call a 905 or 509, I forget, it was a 9 horse. And that year, Poygan opened up, which it was still open that time. You could fish all year round. Every season. And then later on, they went to one every 5 years. But anyhow, I bought this saw. I was going to go up there and cut holes with it and pay for it. It was like about $150-some at that time. And I cut about three holes, and they weren't made like they are today. And they got wet, and the saw puked out. It wouldn't run. And I was going to cut holes, maybe 10, 12, 15 holes, and pay for the saw.
Charge a few bucks or something?
Yeah, at that time they were charging $10 a hole. Okay. Maybe it was even $5, I forget now. But anyhow, I was so disgusted. I took that chainsaw. I had a pair of gloves. And I took the chainsaw by the bar. And my friend was with me, and he opened the tailgate. And I was going to put it in. I took the saw, and I threw it up against the back of the truck. I was so disgusted because I figured, you know, here we go. No chainsaw. So now I got rid of it, and the following year I started building these saws. There's one of them right there. I built that for the Boys Brigade. And then they built another one after that. And
that was in the 60s, you said, when you first built
it? Gosh, I can't remember. Is there a date on here or not? 85 then. But this, I built saw long before that.
Yeah, do you remember when you first started building them? Was that the 60s too?
God, I would say it had to be, I'd say maybe 78, 9, somewhere in there.
Okay. And was there any of those around on the lake before?
No, not to my knowledge, no. Uh-huh. No, there was nothing that I know of. Everybody had either chisel them or hand sawed them or used chainsaws. And so I figured it was a better way, so I made one. And then Al Hozell, the builders and Nina here at that time, they built my home. We were good fishing friends. And he asked me if I'd build him one, so I did. And then naturally his brother wanted one, so I built one for him. And then I built my own, which I had. I kept giving the one I built to him, you know. And then I finally got my own. I hung on to it, and I built, I think it was like 23 of them all together after that.
Most of them give away for free, or did you sell most of them?
Well, mostly my friends, I'd give them for whatever it cost to build it, like the engine and the bar and the chain and the bearings and stuff. Well, most of the bearings and stuff I got right from the plant. You know, they'd run these bearings, these pillow block bearings for so long, and they'd discard them, put new ones on, and there would be nothing wrong with them. You know, for a saw that runs so slow, it ain't like these high-speed machines. So I got a lot of my material from the plant.
It seems like a lot of people around this area who make, most people do make their own things for spearing, but a lot of people get their materials, a lot of them people work in the paper mills around here, and they get their materials from the paper mills too.
As long as you're speaking of that, a friend of mine, Jerry Delavitt, he was a maintenance foreman, and he lives across the lake, brother town. Anyhow, I used to build these saws in the plant at night, and when it'd be, just the foreman would be around, and he wouldn't bother the person, the operating personnel foreman, Anyhow, one night, my maintenance foreman came in, and here I'm working on a bench on somebody's parts for the saw. He says, "Them parts don't look familiar for the diaper machines." I said, "Well, Jerry," I says, "no, they're not." I says, "I'm making an ice saw." I says, "I got about 5 made, and I got to get 2 of them done real quick." He looked at me, and he shook his head. He said, "What next?" he said. And he was going out the door, and he says, "How long does it take you to make them?" I says, "Well, if I don't get bothered too much, this don't take too long." I says, "Why?" He says, "I gotta have one." I says, "You're kidding." He says, "No," I says, "you build me one." Then he said to me, "So, how do you get these out of the plant?" I said, "You don't want to know."
With the old Johnny Cash song, "One Piece at a Time."
No, they'd be completely assembled. I used to take them up way in the back shed, you know, and put them back there. Anyhow, the operating personnel foreman, he did help me carry them out. I'd back the truck up to the door, and he'd help me put them in the truck. Yeah, and the foreman. Yeah. But anyhow, that's how I. So, now what else do we got to have here?
We can go any direction. We can talk about. Let's talk about your spears and from beginning to end, where you get the materials from, and how you go. Step us through the construction and try to be detailed.
Yeah. Well, the forks, I used to go to the old farm markets, and I had a lot of them home on a farm, and usually 4-tine or 3-tine pitchforks, and then I'd throw them in a wood burner and straighten them out, and I had a big anvil, and then I'd pound them straight, and then I would take quarter-inch keystock, and I'd cut it into 1-1/4 strips, and I'd bend the shape of a barb, and then I would, after they were straightened out, and then I'd take a file and smooth them all out and shine them up, and then I'd braise these barbs on. And then I'd cut the tang off that goes into the handle of a pitchfork, which is square, and I'd cut those off, and then I'd put a shoulder bolt on, a machined shoulder bolt. I'd cut the head so it fit the top of the fork of the spear, and then I'd braise those on there. And then I'd put a pin in there. And then the shafts I used to turn out on a lathe, and they're like 13 to 14 pounds, tapered. There's a 10-inch straightaway for the handle, and then there's tapers off down to, I think it was 5/5 of an inch, and I bore a 1/2-inch hole in there for the tang of the spearhead to fit in. And then it had a groove cut in it with a pin in the tang of the spear so it wouldn't turn. And then I'd fasten the handle on, and sometimes I'd burn them with a torch to make them look nice, you know, a burnt handle, wood burnt handle. And then we'd attach our ropes to them. And,
where'd you get the metal? Where do you get the metal? It's a metal shaft, right?
Yeah, right. It's a half inch. It's a half inch.
Did you get that from the Kimberly Clark too, or?
Yes. I said I had pretty good in there. All the time the foreman or something wanted something, I'd make it for him or this or that. Mm-hmm. And yes, I got a lot of material from there. Then I used to go to the Napic junkyard too and pick up a lot of it if I did. I needed it. Mm-hmm. And the shaft was 1¼ inches. And then I'd bore them out for the handle, which would leave you an 1/8 inch lip all the way around the outside of the handle. And then the taper would be, I think the taper was like about maybe 15 to 16 inches long from the straightaway of the shaft. And then we'd mount the handle in there and pin it. So, because when they dry out, they kind of get loose. Now, right now, hanging in the shop there, they're loose. But as soon as I get on the lake, I put them down in the water. In about 5 minutes, they swell up and they're tight again. Otherwise, they kind of wobble before that.
How long is the finished spear then? About
shucks.
6-7 feet?
Let's see. I would say the handles are maybe 8 feet. And the 30-inch shaft, 8 feet. And what? Not almost 11. What? 11, 10 feet. About 10 foot.
And you said they weigh about?
The shaft itself weigh about 13 to 14 pounds. And then the handle probably weighs another pound and a half or two.
Mm-hmm.
And the handles are 1¼ inches. Hardwood. Hickory mostly. I used to get those from Oshkosh Truck and Oshkosh, but they're long, no longer there.
You just go to the lumber yard then? And
well,
do you turn those on your lathe or do you just buy the handles already?
I buy them already made from them.
Okay.
And they made them like for tools, like these sewer trench tools, you know, that the handles on, that's what those are all made for, and long fork handles and so on and so forth. And, let's see.
So once you got it fully assembled, then you got to deal with the rope, right?
Pardon me?
Once you got it fully assembled.
Then I use a 1/4-inch nylon, braided nylon line, 1/4-inch. And I don't know what the tensile strength of it is, but I've never had a sturgeon come or near breaking it. I would say it's got to be 1,000 pounds or a better tensile strength. And then we'd fashion, my ropes carry about 60 foot. And I say from, then the handle, not through the handle, the hole through the handle, the knot goes, the rope goes through there. So you got about 10 foot of rope and the fish will drag that handle behind him 10 feet behind the spear because it comes out of the shaft. And like I said, there's like about 50, 60 foot of rope on there. And the reason I do that is a lot of times if you get a bad shot, which is that one hanging on a wall that was right near the tail, they get pretty wild. And you want a lot of rope, you don't want to snub them off because they will rip out. And I've never had that happen, but I do know a fellow that did happen to. And so you just kind of play them out, and then I play them out so they come up, lay it flat in the hole, and they don't move, they're all tuckered out, and I grab this rope, and I grab them by the gills, and I drag them out on the floor, and then they lay there like a baby. They will hardly move after they're once out of the water.
Now, you were saying you've never used a gaff hook?
Never used a gaff hook in my life. Never. I never had to. I learned this technique about bringing a rope from the spear up to the gills, and then let's drag them out on the floor.
Just grab by the gills and drag them out.
Yeah.
Who taught you that?
I just kind of picked it up myself.
It wasn't Adi or anything?
No. I think Adi used the gaff. I'm not sure, but I think he used the gaff hook.
Okay.
So, but, I can't say for sure, but I assume that he did.
Yeah.
Most people do.
Mm-hmm.
And my sons, they don't use the gaff hook either.
They picked up your technique. Yeah.
Like the gaff hook I showed you, I think I made about 15, 20 of them different guys. You know, one of them, you know.
Mm-hmm. And how many children do you have, and do they all spear?
I got 2 boys and 3 girls, and the 2 boys are crazier about fishing than I am. One of them lives up at Fremont, and the other one lives here in town. Matter of fact, he's maintenance man for Festival Stores, which my daughter is married to one of the fellas that owns them, and so he's got a good job there. And other than that, the other boy, he worked for Kimberly Clark in the same place I did. Only he worked in the shipping part of it. And that place is end up to close, I guess, the end of the year. The diaper plant, they're going to shut it down, so he'll be out of a job. But he's got, I think, 27 or 28 years in it. So he don't know what he's going to do, but he drove semi for Kimberly-Clark there, from one plant to the other. So he's already offered jobs driving semi, but he don't know if he wants to do that or not.
Did you take them out at earliest age, out on the ice?
Yeah, I got pictures that I'll show you. They're like about 5 and 6 years old, and they'd be out there. I got some of the pictures in here, that little guy standing alongside of some other fish. And yeah, they were pretty well influenced. Matter of fact, I had to almost hang on to them when the fish had come in a hole because they wanted to do their job, too.
Did they ever fall in the hole or anything like that?
No, and that never happened.
So take me through the spearing technique. Like, how, when you see one coming in the hole, how do you have your spear? How do you do it, and why? What's the rationale?
Well, first of all, mostly I lay down. I got these big Davenport cushions, what I showed you. And I lay those on the floor, and the shanties, I think, are 9 foot long, and maybe 10, I forget now. But anyhow, I lay down, so because you could, that way, by laying down, you can see way under the ice farther, and you can see the fish come in, and you can prepare yourself before it gets to in spearing range. And then I just lay there like this, and I got a pillow underneath my chin here. And then when they do come in, you don't want to move when they're coming at you, which I found out. I'll explain that later. Anyhow, you just kind of wait till they get their head past you or whatever they're doing, and they'll come in real slow, very, very slow. And then you wait till they eyeballs can't get you, and then you make your move for your spear. You get up and take your spear, and I run it down the water, and I just kind of follow the fish, and I just chuck it as hard as I can. Just chuck it with two fingers and a thumb on each hand. And if you throw it, it'll make that fish, that spear, deviate from one side to the other. It isn't a clear shot, a straight shot. So I just chuck them. And like I say, I've never missed a fish yet. Not that I'm bragging or complaining, but I've never missed one yet. And I've taken some long shots, and I see the shafts I got and the spears I got, they go just like a lance. And some of these fellas, they got spears that are 10, 12 inches wide. I've seen them already as high as 13 inches wide. They just don't travel through the water. They deflect one way or the other because there's too much resistance going through the water. It's like a fin on a fish or the tail of a fish that fluctuates too much. So I stick with these 4-tine spears or 3-tine, and that's about it.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And yours are probably, what, only like 7 inches wide or something like that?
Pardon me?
Your spear is probably only like, what, 7 inches?
I think they're like 8 inches.
8 inches. Yeah.
Maybe 9 at the most. Yeah. And 4-tine. Mm-hmm. And then there's the 2 outside tines. They've got a barb out and in, staggered about an inch apart. One on each side of the outside tines. And in the center tines, I got one barb on each tine. Mm-hmm. And I've speared nice fish, big fish. Besides the one on the wall, I had a 102-pound male, which there's pictures in here of it. And I've never lost a fish. But the main thing is to play the fish out. Don't let him go unless he's getting to the end of the rope, then you want to kind of snub him off, But don't let him get to the end by himself, because that's when people lose their fish.
Because they pull out then?
Yeah, big snapper at all. But with the spears I got, not that I'm bragging, but I don't think a fish would even pull off of them, because I have yet to be able to pull a spear out. I always got to cut them out. You got to cut them. Because when a barb goes through that tough hide, it kind of stretches it. Then when it gets inside, the barbs, they can't come back out. And that hide is just like leather, So it takes an awful lot to have to lose a fish unless you got awful poor equipment. And I did see a lot of equipment out there that I wouldn't even put them in my junk barrel. It's just people should use a little common sense when they do, because that's a prehistoric fish, and the cotton pickers, it takes so long to get of spearing age, and it's a dirty shame to waste them,
And so you have to actually cut off your ends to get.
Oh, definitely the spear off, yeah, yeah.
Somebody was telling me about the ones that have the removable.
Oh, the flying barbs.
Or you can remove the ends and then you can just pull it up.
Yeah. They can thread the tines from the shaft or the bar across. Yeah, they're probably all right in my book.
Probably easier to break, though. They probably break a little bit easier.
Well, they're so cumbersome. They look like a big, heavy hunk of iron, you know. They got to have a real wide bar on top in order to bolt these tines onto it. And I've seen them already, and I wouldn't want
one. Yeah. When you see one coming into the hole, do you like to get your spear almost as close as you can get to before you chuck it, or you
right
just kind of...
Yeah, unless he's outside the hole a long ways, well, you can't. But I've already had him come in a hole and bump the decoy and stay right there. You know, just bump it, and the decoy will come back and bump him right back on the nose. I've had a little snot come in one time. I would say it was maybe a 30-pounder or so. Come in and hit my decoy, and the decoy went flying. The fish went outside of the hole. He made a circle maybe where I couldn't see him, maybe 10 feet out, came right back and hit that cotton-picking decoy again. And he did that two times. And I thought, well, he was a crazy little devil, you know. It was amazing to see, you know.
I think he was playing?
Yeah. They're a curious fish. I mean, that's what brings them into this decoy. They're very, very curious fish. They got no fear unless a fast movement, like I say, if somebody throws something in a hole or something. Even if you throw something in a hole, I don't think that it'd spook. Because they're the kingpin out there, the biggest fish in the lake.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they fear much of anything.
Mm-hmm.
So, matter of fact, Al Hozell and Ed Hozell, some friends of mine, I built them, used to saw that when they were cutting on a chainsaw at that time, a very curious fish, like I said, they were cutting on, all of a sudden the chainsaw was snubbed and burp, 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 and, you know, kept, and finally it run again, and here comes a bunch of fish flesh up, and they determined it was a sturgeon. See, he saw that bar moving down in the water, and he came up, and he got hit with it. Or he maybe made a pass at it. That happened to Ed and Al Hozell.
Did they ever get the fish, or no?
Oh, no, they were cutting a hole that was start for it and fishing. Matter of fact, I don't even know if it was opened, and I might see you can cut about 2 days before, you know. Mm-hmm. So it may have been during the season, or it may have been before. I can't recall. But, it came right up and hit the saw.
Someone probably speared one later on with a big... gash.
Well, I don't think that. Talking about that, Keith Schrader, and I got pictures of him, and I think I got pictures of the fish. He was fishing off Payne's Point, and a fish came in a hole, and he moved, and the fish dove almost straight down. And he speared at it, and he figured it grazed the head. God's truth, the next day, the same shanty, and I got pictures of the fish right here, but I don't have it close enough to see the scars. The same fish, he speared it, and it had that groove down the head of his head. That's, he figured the same one that he missed the day before.
Came back for more.
Well, see, they do hang in the same area, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, I got pictures of that fish in here. I think that's in here.
Yeah, they kind of are, maybe I haven't gotten into this much, the nature of the sturgeon. Are they territorial? Do they have their own water that they patrol, or do they just go anywhere they want?
I think they. My theory is they go all over and anywhere. It's just because if you do get into a school, you may be on them for a couple, 2-3 days. Yes, that happens. However, we've already sat up on Stevens Reef out there. That's when the Hozells fished with me. And my boys, I think we had 5 shacks out there. And I think there's a pictures of it in here. I think we got 4 or 5 fish in 2 days on that same group of fish. And I say the pictures are in here of those fish. And yeah, they'll school. Matter of fact, there was one time I was across the lake over fishing off of Quinney, and just my dad and myself was over there, and he had already speared one about 80 pounds. I think there might be pictures of that in here too. Anyhow, he come and sat with me, and it was like about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and we were maybe a half mile offshore, and God's truth, while we were sitting there, was 5 different sturgeon came from the west, which is from our side of the lake here, going east on the other side where we're sitting, went through the hole. They weren't curious looking at decoys or nothing. They just, like, they're going in there to feed. There was 5 or 6 different fish we saw within an hour's time. But there was nothing huge, like 30 pounds, 40 pounds.
Nothing legal.
Yeah. And then there was another story. When my dad, he speared one, and about 80 or 90 pounds, I think it was. Anyhow, he run the tavern in Fremont, Pitts's Tavern, as my folks run that. After my dad died, then my mother remarried to Florence Stetzel. Anyhow, they run that Pitts's Tavern in Fremont. Anyhow, a friend of his, Clyde Nielsen, the day after he got his fish, he had Clyde and his wife sit with him. I mean, sit in the shack. And he said, well, I said, I'm going to go down and see my nephew, he said, he's down the line a ways, which is my stepbrother, or my sister's husband. Anyhow, he no more than left, and he happened to look out in the mirror at the back, and here she's outside waving frantically. He said, oh, my God. He says, what happened? The guy, the old man fall in the hole or something? He turned around and beat her back, and here he had a fish that was equivalent to the one he had, about 80 or 90 pounds. Now, that was them two fish in 2 days that was in that 80, 90-pound class. And it just one of those, he wasn't in the shack 5 minutes.
Yeah. Let's talk about your dad. Your dad, you learned it from your dad. Did your dad learn it from his dad? Tell me about that.
No, my dad, my mother and them got divorced when I was, I think, about 3 years old. And then she married my stepdad. And he wasn't much into fishing.
Stepdad or
your dad? Yeah, that's my stepdad. And so I picked up most of my information I got from John Jurgis' dad, Oddie Jurgison.
Okay.
And John Dunlock, my biology teacher at high school. So that's where I got. And then I'd say I was an influenced fisherman from the time I was big enough to carry a fish pole or whatever, and I just went on from there, that's all.
Oh, okay. do you do all your own cleaning of the fish and all that stuff?
Oh, yes, definitely.
How do you do that? How do you step through the cleaning process?
Right there on the cupboard.
Right there in the kitchen?
I'll take them on a shop and hang them and skin them out and everything. But then I got pictures of that too, cutting them all up on the cupboard. And I got a big cutting board. And then I should have showed you, I got a big walk-in smokehouse back at the garage. And I used to fish salmon too. We smoked a lot of salmon.
You use like hickory or apple?
Hickory and apple. Yeah. Mostly apple. Hickory is a little sharper. Mm-hmm. But mostly apple. And then I built a big fire in there, and I could hang anywhere from 8 or 9 of those big salmon, like 20 pounds. And I used to smoke them for guys I worked with for their weddings and stuff, their kids' weddings. I used to smoke them for them.
Same thing with sturgeon. People would come and say, hey, can you smoke this for me?
No, sturgeon I never smoked.
Oh, okay.
But the salmon I did. But the sturgeon I smoked my own too. But now I don't smoke that much, so I got a small smoker I use now to smoke them with.
Okay, so if you don't smoke your sturgeon, how do you like to prepare your sturgeon?
First of all, they're an awful tallowy fish. They're marbled with fat, real yellow fat throughout the whole fish. And you got to get rid of most of that because it's a real off taste. It's not good. And it's a big process in cleaning them. But if you smoke them, you don't have to. And then you just soak them in brine for about 12 to 14, 15 hours in salt brine. And then just throw them in a smoker. Hang them up. I got a lot of hooks I use for hanging fish. And I got them in a shop.
Do you usually just fry your sturgeon then, or do you usually just fry your sturgeon, or
if it's a big fish,
bake them?
The tail maybe, the portion I'll fry, but most of it I'll smoke, because I say it's so tallowy and greasy, you know, and by smoking it eliminates a lot of that. The tallow juice or grease will drip out of it. So. Mm-hmm. But mostly I smoke them, and I prefer it smoked. I get a lot of fresh walleyes and perch out here. I'd rather eat those than fresh fried sturgeon.
What about changes in the sport since you were a kid to now? I'm sure there's a lot of differences now in the sport.
Johnny Jurgison probably told you the same thing. When I first started, you could buy 5 tags for $1, 5 sturgeon tags.
For $1 or a nickel or for a quarter?
It was 5 for $1, it was. It could have been a quarter. Maybe it was a quarter a piece. And now when I started, you could have 3 fish yet. And then from then on, a few years later, they went to 1.
You started, you said you were born in 31?
31,
so you were probably wartime era, just after World War II, you started spearing? Is that when you started?
Say it again.
You started spearing just after World War II era?
Well, I started spearing, I graduated in 1950 from high school in Nino. Oh, okay. And I fished a year before that. 49 I started.
Okay.
I was using my biology teacher, fishing, John Gunlock. Mm-hmm. And then our gym coach, we called him Fubby Gerhardt, he was into sturgeon fishing also. So there was quite a few teachers at the high school at that time did fish sturgeon. But when I first started fishing, the only place anybody ever went was the Outer Bar just outside of Nino. And there'd maybe be 15, 20 shacks on this whole end of the lake here. That's all it was in 50. Nobody fished. And then I started cruising around. I'd go out in the reefs out here and fish. They always fished in an outer bar reef just outside of the Nina Boat Works there, or the ramp, I should say, the boat launch. And it's only about a half a mile out. And that's where everybody fished. They'd line up there just like cows in a stanchion, you know. And I started cruising the lake. I was the only one that ever did that. And everybody started after that.
Well, was there a bunch of people on the east shore, too?
The east shore, they did more sturgeon fishing over there than anybody on the lake at that time. Yeah, I would say there'd be 10 times more shacks over there on the east shore than there were on this side. Hardly anybody fished over here.
Well, the funny thing is there's 10 times the population on the west shore as there is on the east shore.
But, I mean, sturgeon fishing back in the 50s, it was, I mean, nobody was interested in this. I don't know why.
Was it fished out and there wasn't that many at that point? Or maybe it was kind of a sport that emerged around that time?
I don't know. And it's hard to see. I think the population of fish was down then, too, than what it is today, because you have so cotton picking many poachers in the river. Mm-hmm. I mean, they would just poach sturgeon like you wouldn't believe when they were spawning. I mean, I got pictures when they were spawning up here when I was on sturgeon patrol. You can reach down and grab them by the tail. I got pictures of it. My boys grabbing them by the tail.
Very vulnerable at that point.
Yeah. I mean, they got no fear. I mean, you can stand right there and they'll come and swim right against your hand or your legs. They'll rub right against you.
So when did since there were so few shacks in the 50s, when did the sport really start taking off? And maybe why?
I would say probably in the middle 60s. Middle 60s, I think it has started to fluctuate quite a bit compared to what it had been. And then, like I say, in the 70s when I started building these saws or whatever it was, 79 or whatever, and it really took off. And then now there's so cotton picking many of them out there, it's unreal. You know, we only get a 6-hour day spearing sturgeon day, 6 hours. And then the cotton picking DNR yet, sometimes I don't agree with them. They open it up at 6:30 in the morning. Well, God Almighty, you can't, or 6 o'clock, I think it is. You can't see till 7:30. And then they close it at 12:30. Yeah, 6:30 to 12:30. And so you lose 1 hour of fish right off the bat. And I think they set it up purposely for that, because there ain't no way you can see a fish in the wintertime, for God's sake, at 7 o'clock. Through the ice, under the ice, no way.
Do people set up lights or anything, like big old floodlight in their, they can see down the hole?
No, but before they, this is like about, I'd say back, it would have to be maybe 90s, in the 90s, middle 90s, you could fish at night with a light. And my boys did it, and it was fantastic. Them sturgeon would come for that light, looks like, I don't know, like kids of candy.
Like you said, they were curious. I would think that that beam of light would be.
And they did fantastic. Well, the DNR cut that out after about, they found out how results was coming out of it and how bad it was. They cut that out in a hurry. Then you couldn't fish at night. That's when they went to, I think, a 6-hour day then, too. But I used to go out there. I used to go out, never went before 8 o'clock. Because you couldn't see nothing hardly before 8. You know, dark water, winter times, if you got a good snow cover, you know, the light just don't penetrate.
Sleeping.
Yeah. So anyhow, I'd go out at 8 and then I'd fish till 4. And I'd always take 2 weeks vacation for it from the plant. I'd take 2 weeks vacation from sturgeon fishing. But now I say it's a 6-hour day, and sometimes it lasts, 7-8 days, it's over with. Now last year it lasted the whole season because the water clarity was so bad. Matter of fact, I only fished, I think, 6 days last year, and I said, walleye, I'm going to go fish walleyes. Walleye fishing was fantastic on Poygan. You'd go out there and get a limit of fish pretty every day. You know, with jigging with a little leech and these spikes, we call them. And so rather than sit out in Winnebago, because you only could see 3-4 feet. Down towards Fondlac, they could see sometimes 8 and 9 feet. But I wasn't going to drive my shanties all the way down to Fondlac and then back and forth every day. So we just pulled our shacks and went pike fishing.
So you can't leave your shack overnight?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you can.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, you can leave. But then, and you got, 24 hours, I think, to get them off after the end of the season. And you can put them out 2 days before. I mean, you can have them out there all the time, but you can't cut your hole till 2 days before. And after the hole is once cut, after it's closed, as long as the hole is open, you can't fish it. But you can leave your shanty there until March, 4th or 5th, I forget what it is, and you got to get them off. but you can leave your certain shack out there all winter long.
I've heard this before, that people would take vacation from their jobs during. Did a lot of people take their 2-week vacation or something around these parts?
I would say my boys did the same thing. And like the Hosells, they were some of the more prominent fishermen. They were contractors, build homes. They built my home here. They just didn't build during the surge season. They went fishing.
So that's interesting about the economic impact of the sturgeon spearing to this area. I figure the bars probably do really well. Probably make it's like their Christmas season or something like that.
Unreal.
But then the rest of the big businesses, like the mills and, like you said, the contractors, well, most of them aren't working.
Yeah. Now that you mentioned the taverns, when I got this 6-pound fish, we went there on a Monday night. It was the highest one on the pool. I got the list of the whole thing. Anyhow, there was two fellas from Oshkosh in there. One of them was Chainsaw Joe, and that was his nickname, and I can't think of the other fellow's name, but he was one of the better of the two. Anyhow, there was just the wife and I, and then Arnie Lansworth, he run the tavern, and that's where we always registered our fish there. The DNR had a scale there. And these guys are talking to Arnie and amongst themselves about what a lousy fishing setup we had over here. No clubs, no roads plowed, no nothing. And I was just sitting on the chair, just kind of dancing like that. And I said, sit down, just stay. And finally, I said, Bo. I got up and I said, I couldn't help but listen to your conversation here with Arnie, the tavern keeper. I said, about nobody interested in fishing over here, no bridges, no. I said, I'll tell you what. I got $25 right here. I says, let's start a club. Arnie Langworth looked at me, the tavern keeper. He says, here's my 25. He went to till, got 25 off. And I said, these two fellas, and I said, you've been complaining about no fishing excess over here, no clubs, no road. No. I said, let's start a club. I said, how about it? I said, we'll sell so many memberships and we'll start the club. They both looked at me and looked at each other, and they both forked out $25. So we had $100 right there. And that's how our club started. Payne's Point, Hook and Spear.
That's the Payne's Point. That's how it started?
Yeah, and I started it. I was president for the first 2 years, but then I worked nights a lot. At that time, I could work days, but I always chose nights because I could do my government work, and I preferred the shift work better than days because I could fish during the daytime. Anyhow, for 2 years, I was president of it, and then Randy Pughes took over for a year, and then Wayne Hosell, he's heads of the North Chapter, and he took over and was president then for, the longest time. And then he'd be, matter of fact, I think I probably would have had the same job on the North Shore as he did had I not worked in Shickle. We both went down to that Fond du Lac, or was it Oshkosh, Fond du Lac. They had a meeting with Casper, the fellow that set up this sturgeon for tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And anyhow, then Wayne took over the presidency of the North Chapter here, and which I'm glad I was working, because I probably would have been in on it, and that's a big headache.
when was the when did you start? What year was that about for the Payne's Point Hook and Spear? Is that in the 80s or?
And Arnie Lansworth, he's dead. His wife is dead. But I'm sure that the fellow at the tavern right now, I can't think of his name. I'm sure he would know. But gosh, I can't remember when this started. We held them right down to the tavern. Had a back room. That's where we held our meetings.
And then, what was the name of that tavern? That's the
Payne's Point.
It's the Payne's Point Tavern.
It's still there.
Okay.
Right in the corner up here. And then we built a clubhouse, which is there now too. If you go down Lakeshore Drive here, maybe about 2 miles, you'll see the sign Payne's Point Hook and Spear.
Okay.
We built a great big clubhouse there. And then we built our own bridges, metal bridges. We got two plows. V plows for plowing, and what else? Oh, then we got a plaque of all the chartered members in gold, and big plaque with our names on it, the ones who started the club. The interesting thing, I'll go down and take a picture. They got their meetings, I think. I'd have to find out. I ain't been there for so long. Here's on a Monday night. And that'd be interesting to go there sometime for you. How far you come, Sheboygan, though, huh?
I live in Madison now, but
Madison. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
That's only about hour and 15 minutes.
It's real interesting. They really held a good meeting.
And so the original mission of the Payne's Point Hook and Spear was to plow and make bridges?
Strictly sturgeon.
Yeah.
Nothing else. No, no pike fishing activities. They're just strictly sturgeon. And it was a big asset for the fishermen on this side because nobody had any equipment like that. Even Waverly Beach didn't have it. And so I figured myself real fortunate to be one of the starters of it, along with the rest of the fellows that was chartered members. And my hat's off to them because, it really helped out the city here and the fishermen access to get on the lake and so on and so forth. Then we bought the property we bought it from Miles Bear. He had a farm right across the road from it, and he gave it to us for almost nothing, lake frontage. It's a small portion, but he almost gave it to us for nothing.
Wow.
I don't think it's over 15, 18 years ago.
Okay, when you started it.
Yeah.
But, okay. So right around the late 80s, by 1990.
Yeah. I could find out if you really, I just have a, it was called a tavern.
No, well, that's something I didn't know, and that was nice that we uncovered about starting the Payne's Point Club. Is this your biggest fish here that you have hanging on the wall?
Right, yeah.
Can you tell me the story of that, how that fish came in, and tell me the story of the experience?
My friend Dick Rutherland, he was a kind of a, just an average sturgeon fisherman, wasn't really interested that much, and he wanted to go sturgeon fish, so him and I went out on Stevens Reef, just the two of us, each had our own shack, and we cut in, like about maybe 7 o'clock in the morning, and I sat, usually if I don't see a fish by noon, we like to move. Anyhow, at 11 o'clock, I hadn't seen a fish, so I walked over to Dick, which was maybe 100 yards away from me, to the south of me, and I was facing north. We both faced north at the time, but he was south of me. And I walked in the shack, and I was going to ask him about if he's seen anybody. Right away, he started talking small talk, this and that. And then finally, I interrupted him about after 15 seconds. I said, Dick, I says, have you seen any sturgeon, fish? Oh, yeah, he says, just before you come to the door, he says, there was that yellow glow right out here in front. He says, I don't know what it was. He said, it was dissipated. The water was only about 10 foot clarity is all it was, maybe 8 feet. Anyhow, he says, matter of fact, he says, headed right towards your direction. God's truth. Out the doggone door, never even bothered to shut it, and I run to my shack, sat down on a little chair, breathing hard. God's truth, I looked down and 10 feet outside the hole and about 8 feet down there was that yellow glow. And there the fish was. I threw the spear into it and I didn't know how big it was, but I knew it was legal, but I didn't know how big. And when I hit it with that spear, all hell broke loose. I hit him that far back to the tail because all I could see was that much of the fish. The rest would dissipate in the water. It was so dirty. And I should say cloudy, not dirty. And that was the end of that story.
How long is it?
70 and a half.
70 and a half inches?
And
did it weigh how
33
much?
On the girth. I got 33 on the girth. And 70 and a half and 33 on the girth. And the DNR said she spawned a year before. They opened it. They take the intestines, the samples. And they said that she carried a spawn. She would have been 130 to 135 pounds. And that was a big fish at that time. Now, 110, 15 pounds is nothing. Matter of fact, they're getting about 180 pounds now.
Yeah, that one lady on the lake got that one. Wasn't that lady's name on the lake that got 170-some pounder, 180? I think she might be on the East Shore.
Darlene Holman.
Yeah.
I got pictures of her right here.
Yeah.
It was 158 pounds. But
and that one had spawned out the year before, too, I think.
Now, I don't know if I should tell you this or not. But anyhow, I heard about Darlene's fish. She got rid of a blackbird. She's the only one always sitting there in the Blackbird Island, right there, and there's Payne's Point. She was sitting right out there in the island. Anyhow, there was about 4 or 5 fish laying on the floor at the tavern there, in the fishing quarters of it. I walked in. I knew most fishermen. I said, where's Darlene's fish? And I had walked right by it. It was laying on the floor. And they said, well, it was right there. I says, come on. And then Bobby Holman, her husband, I said, Bob, I says, this Darlene's fish? He said, yeah. I said, Bob, this is for the devil. I says, I want to measure this fish. And I did. And we measured the girth on it. And it was just a shade larger than this one. Okay. Then Bill Olson, he lives about 8 places down the road here. He come in there the same day with a fish. It was about a 30, 35 pound fish. The scale hung on the outside. They put it on the scale and they pulled the rope to pull him up. And it weighed 55 pounds. And Bill says, no way does that fish weigh that kind of weight. He said, I'm happy to have it weigh that much, but he said, it don't weigh that much. So we went right over to Waverly Beach and weighed the fish, and it was in the 30-pound class, okay? This scale, which the DNR picked up the next morning, and there's people that will verify this, when you put that fish on the initial giant, where that scale stopped, that's where it stayed. So when you pull something like that, you know, you put a jolt to it and the scale...
It didn't shoot back up and let back to zero.
It didn't go back where it was supposed to. Just like any of these scales here. I mean, when you, the initial jerk, you know, like that, and that's where it stayed.
And it would reset.
The DNR picked up the next day. So I figured her fish... Is that on the microphone?
Yeah.
I figured her fish was probably 120 pounds at the most.
Yeah, which is no small feat, but...
No, it was still a nice fish. It really was a nice fish. But I say, I probably have no business saying what I did, but I mean, that's the exact story. Whether people want to know it or hear it or not, that's the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way it was. And there's people at the tavern, Bill Olson for one, they'll verify that. In a DNR, I'm sure if they got records of it, they'll verify that they picked the scale up the next day, too. And they put a new, different scale up.
Yeah. I'm sure it was when she caught that fish, I'm sure there's people coming from all over. Just
yeah, right.
Ones
yeah.
that word
yeah,
travels
I
fast.
I saw pictures in there of it with the fish.
So how fast does word travel on this lake when a certain spot is hot or somebody catches something?
Years back, it didn't matter. It didn't matter too much. Until maybe about... middle 70s, then everything started to boom, and it didn't take long. I mean, all they had to do was go to the registration stations and look. You know, the guy was interested enough in fishing. Go to the registration station and see where the fish are being registered. You know, talk to anybody there, and they give you a pretty good clue where the fish are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Especially with cell phones, too, I bet.
Pardon?
With cell phones nowadays.
Yeah, too. Right, yeah. Yeah, and cell phones or something else. But that's a big thorn in my craw, them cell phones. No matter when I go to town, there's all, and mostly women, not that I can get, I mean, I can see them pull right out of the street that they live on, and they're out of cotton picking food already. Gee whiz, you know. And then they get on the highway, and then I thought to myself, my gosh, you know, how can they concentrate on driving and talking on a phone with one hand to start with?
Yeah. Do you have any stories of the Indian spearing way back and when that were passed down to you, or any knowledge of that at all?
Not really.
No.
Not really. No.
What about, has it always been illegal, or was there ever any, or maybe just private individuals doing any kind of commercial sturgeon spearing or commercial caviar?
Yeah, there was.
On the lake, or shipping it or transporting it?
Matter of fact, I think I didn't put the pictures in here. There was a picture, I don't know when it was taken. Oh, gosh. It was in the early 1900s, where there was three guys, they had about 7 or 8 sturgeon on a string, and they were commercial, I imagine commercially, gathering them for whatever reason, I don't know, but yeah, I got a picture of that, and I don't think I put it in here, but and the Indians, I'm sure they had some wonderful sturgeon fishing at the time, you know, when they were spawning. Like I say, my boys was catching them by their hand, you know. I got pictures of it.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't even have to spear them, you know.
They just pick up, grab by the gill almost.
Yeah, I can remember one time up by the Dogs and Suds in New London. There's a friend of mine that had a place on the river there. And Melvin Glotz and myself, we went down there and they were spawning. And we went down in the evening with a bright light, because that's usually when they're more dormant. And God's truth, I'll bet you we saw 20, 25 sturgeon. And they were lined up on an angle like this against the current. just like cows in a stanchion. I couldn't believe it. I mean, fish that was 100 pounds. I just couldn't believe it. And then the river was being patrolled, and about that time a patrol boat went by. And matter of fact, they even pulled in to see if we were up to any no good, which we weren't, you know. And we talked them a while, and they said, yeah, they said they've been having trouble, a lot of poaching. Now, I mean, this is back again, early 80s maybe. So, yeah, the poaching was big time for sturgeon.
Do you have any poaching stories, not you personally, but people you know, poaching stories, what you know goes on? You know, if it's over 6 years ago, you can't be held liable or anything like that. But
yeah, I know a few, but I don't want to comment on them.
Okay, that's fine. Are you into caviar at all?
No. Can't stand it. I tried commercial caviar. But I got rid of a lot of mine. I'd give it away whoever wanted it, you know. But I only had two fish, I think, all those years that had ripe caviar. They got to carry it for, 5 years before it's ripe, and it's got to be black before it's ripe. I think there's only one or two fish that I had that had ripe caviar.
And then you just gave it away?
Pardon?
You just gave the caviar away?
Yeah.
Do you know how to make it? Have you ever made it?
No. I said, not much of a job, I guess, except that it's kind of tedious, time-taking. Yeah, matter of fact, I got a record of it. I think I speared 58 sturgeon up until the last 3 years, and I haven't speared a fish since then. But I had 58 up until that point, and only two of those 58 had caviar that would have been ripe.
Oh.
And I would say maybe half or maybe a little less than half was females, the rest was males.
Mm-hmm. I had this, I think John was telling me about the Polish people in Menasha used to have these really long spears with like these and different shanty construction with these cupolas.
With a cupola? I had one like that.
With the hole in the top even so they could go even further up.
I got pictures of it. Yes, that's all Jurgensen's fish was, a cupola. I got one in here too.
Was there other towns, like say Stockbridge or other towns that had like their own kind of something unique like that set them apart from other areas in the land?
I think at Stockbridge they started out with the laydown shacks that I got. I think that's where the idea came from. See, the eccentric wheels on there, all you gotta do is stick a bar. Right now I got the wheels up, and you just put a bar in there and pull the wheels down and put a pin through it. Each side, away you go.
Oh, so you say that Stockbridge people invented the kind of shanty on a trailer. It's like they got the wheels, trailers, and all you do is lay it on its side to move it?
Right, yeah, right. Now, the wheels are attached right to the shanty. They're on a pivot, and they're on eccentric. And you just pull them down, put a pin through, hook up, you're ready to go. You don't take your equipment on the shanty or nothing. These other ones, like I started out with the cupola, like Johnny Jurgensen did, I still think he fishes that way. You got to take everything out, practically, or I'll strap it down. And these here, the chairs are nothing. Just pick them up and away you go. Close the door, the trap door for the hole, and away you go.
And is that the prominent shanty type now? Is that
something that's spreading really fast? I would say 90% of your shanties out here right now are that type.
Wow. So once a good idea gets acknowledged, it spreads fast.
Yeah. Some of them I got. The trailer, that they take a snowmobile trailer and they attach it to it. But I would say 40% have got their own wheels set up, you know. But a lot of them are transported on a trailer or strap a trailer to it, a boat trailer or something. I mean, a snowmobile trailer or something.
How long has it... Did the Stockbridge people always construct in that way, or had they only been around for 20 years?
As far as I can recall, they did, yes. I mean, there sure may have been a lot of them that didn't, but the majority of them was these late lay-down shacks. Matter of fact, the Hosells that helped build my house, they helped me build my first one to get started, and that's the shacks they had, and they came from Stockbridge.
All those guys are there from Stockbridge. Yeah. And back then, early on, people on this side, on the West Shore, really didn't have that kind of shanty.
All tip-overs.
All tip-overs.
Yeah, had wheels on, some just had skis on it. I had some with skis on, too. Either way. Put skis on, or if you had a lot of snow, you put skis on.
So. Okay, so that's... Because I can assume that, a long time ago, when it wasn't easy to travel from place to place, like certain towns or certain people had their own ideas, and, over time, I guess, it kind of just all mixed up and everything. But
see, now, that's why I got that smaller shack right there. Sometimes, before we had four-wheelers, we put, you know, to get them big shacks out of a lot of snow was hard to do. So they put skis on these little ones like that and they shove them out. If the ice got bad, if the ice was, some years we didn't even have any decent ice, like 8-10 inches some years we had, that's all we had. And then, you know, you didn't want to take these heavy shanties out with a car or something, so you just shove these smaller ones out. I've already fished sturgeon at the end of the season on the North Shore with these little fish traps. My boys and I went over there. The sturgeon was in there, and you couldn't take a shanty or a car on a lake. We had these little fish traps that we pushed out and fished for the last 3 days of the season like that. You've seen those little fish with the little collapsible, like a convertible roof on them, you know? These little fish sleds.
Oh, yeah. Fish drag traps. Everything out
yeah,
there.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, my brother
people
has
people use them fishing there all the time out here.
Yeah, my brother has one like
that. For bike fishing perch.
Yeah. Well, good. Do you have any memorable moments, something that you'll never forget, sturgeon assisting or sturgeon spearing, a moment, like the most memorable moment, something that was something you'll never forget?
One of them was that one I just got hanging on the wall there, and that's why she's hanging there. My buddy said it wasn't heading my way, and I had run over there, and there it was. And then there was another one time. I can't think of their name. Johnny Hewitt fished with him. Anyhow, my wife and I was in a shanty, and one of the boys, and about that time, two of his buddies pulled up. So there was five of us in the same one here, this lay-down one. So there was my wife and myself and my boy and these other two, so there was five of us in the shanty. And I'm laying down on the floor like I always most generally do, and I looked, and here that fish is going through like this. And I speared it, and I let it go out, brought it back in, and when I got it to where I could see it, I was just sick. The head was almost half again as big as the body. And it was like about maybe 69, 70 inches long. I don't think the fish weighed 65 pounds. It's like a skinny rail.
Like a pike.
Matter of fact, I brought the fish up to the hole. When I saw it, I took the rope and all. I threw the whole cotton picking rope right in the hole. I walked out of the shanty. I was just sick. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. And that same year, Johnny Hewitt and, God darn, I can think of the boys he fished with. Anyhow, the same year, a day or two later, or a day or two before, I forget, had one the same way. That particular year, evidently, was not enough feed for the fish, or there was sickly for some reason or other. I have no idea. But I'll never forget that fish as long as I lived. As skinny as it was, I couldn't believe it.
Did you pull it out after?
Well, actually, we finally took it home. But, I mean, I was so disgusted, I just took the whole rope. You know, I'm figuring 95, 80, 100 pounds, you know. And I pull it up, and I think it weighed, if it weighed 50, maybe I'd be bragging.
Yeah.
Nothing but skin, and just from the head back, nothing. Just, I don't know if I got pictures of it. If not, I'm not sure.
Wow.
Unreal.
Yeah.
Yeah, John Jurgensen's dad, he was one of the best sturgeon fishermen on the lake. Between him and John Gunlock, that's how I learned my fishing.
Well, I think that'll do. It's got about a little over about an hour here, and I think it's only an hour tape, so worked out nicely. And thanks again. And
I think you'll see some of these pictures.
Yeah, we'll look at them.